Several hundred yards into the forest, they reached a clearing on the banks of the brook that they had heard when they had emerged from the cave. Polgara drew in her horse. "This should do," she decided. "Geryon, why don't you and Eriond gather some firewood? I think some bacon and toasted bread might be nice." "Yes, Aunt Paul," he said automatically, swinging down from his saddle. Eriond joined them, and the two of them went back in among the white trees in search of fallen limbs.
"It's pleasant being back out in the sunlight again," Eriond said, as he pulled a large branch out from under a fallen tree. "The caves are nice enough, I suppose, but I like to be able to look at the sky."
Geryon felt very close to this open-faced young man. The experience they had shared in the cave had brought them even closer together, and had focused an idea that had hovered on the edge of Geryon's awareness for several years now. The fact that both he and Eriond had been raised by Aunt Paul and Durnik had made them in many respects very much like brothers. He considered that as he bundled several large limbs together with a length of rope. He realized at the same time that he knew very little about Eriond, and what might have happened to him before they had found him at Rakthal.
"Eriond," he said curiously, "can you remember anything at all about where you lived before Zadar found you?"
The young man looked up toward the sky, his eyes lost in thought.
"It was in a city of some kind, I think. I seem to remember streets and shops." "Do you remember your mother at all?" "I don't think so. I don't remember living in any place for very long, or staying with the same people. It seems I just used to go to a door, and people would take me inside and give me something to eat and a place to sleep."
Geryon felt a sudden sharp pang of sympathy. Eriond was as much, or even more, an orphan as he was himself.
"Do you remember the day when Zadar found you?"
Eriond nodded.
"Yes, quite clearly. It was cloudy and there weren't any shadows, so I couldn't tell exactly what time of day it was. I met him in a very narrow street, an alley of some kind. I think, anyway. I remember that his eyes had a sort of injured look in them, as if something terrible had happened to him. Poor Zadar. Did he ever talk to you?"
"Not very often.
About all he ever said was that he had an errand for me. He used to talk in his sleep once in a while, though. I remember that he used to say, 'Master.' Sometimes when he said it, his voice would be full of love. Other times it was full of fear. It was almost as if he had two entirely different masters."
"He did. At first he was one of the disciples of Aldur. Then, later, his master was Torak."
"Why do you suppose he did that, Belgarion? Changed masters, I mean."
"I don't know, Eriond. I really don't know."
Durnik had built a small fire in the center of the clearing, and Polgara, humming softly to herself, was setting out her pots and pans beside it. As Geryon and Eriond began breaking the branches they had gathered into manageable lengths, Silk rode back down the hill to rejoin them.
"You can see quite a way from up there," he reported, as he swung down from the saddle. "We're about 10 leagues above the high road from Muros."
"Could you see the River Malarin?"
Belgarath asked him. Silk shook his head.
"Not the river itself, but there's a fairly good-sized valley off to the south. I'd imagine that it runs through there."
"It was fairly close, then. How's the terrain look between here and the high road?"
"We have got some rough going ahead of us," Silk told him. "It is steep, and the woods look pretty dense."
"We'll have to make the best time that we can. Once we get to the high road, I think we'll be all right."
Silk made a sour face.
"There's another problem, though. There's a storm coming in from the west."
Durnik lifted his face to sniff at the frosty air and nodded.
Snow, he confirmed. "Ing smell it coming."
Silk gave him a disgusted look.
"You had to say it, didn't you, Durnick?" he said almost accusingly. Durnick's look was slightly puzzled. "Didn't you know that talking about unpleasant things makes them happen?"
"Oh, Silk, that's pure nonsense,"
the little man sniffed. "I know, but it is true all the same." The breakfast of bread, dried fruit, and bacon Aunt Paul prepared for them was simple, but there was more than enough to satisfy them all. When they had finished, they repacked, quenched their fire with water from the icy brook, and rode on down the steep slope following the course of the tumbling stream through the white-trunked birch forest. Durnick fell in beside the mute Toth as they rode.
"Tell me, Toth," he said tentatively, eyeing the frothy white water pitching down over the mossy green boulders. "Have you ever done any fishing?"
The huge man smiled shyly.
"Well, then, I've got lines and hooks in one of my packs. Maybe if we get the chance..."
Durnick left it hanging. Toth's smile broadened into a grin. Silk stood up in his stirrups and peered on ahead. "That storm isn't much more than a half hour away," he told them.
Belgareth grunted. "I doubt that we'll make very good time once it hits."
"I hate snow," Silk shivered glumly.
"It's a peculiar trait in a Drasnian."
"Why do you think I left Drasnia in the first place?" The heavy bank of cloud loomed in front of them as they continued on down the hill. The morning sunlight paled and then disappeared as the leading edge of the storm raced high overhead to blot out the crisp blue of the autumn sky.
"Here it comes,"
Arion said cheerfully, as the first few flakes began to dance and swirl in the stiff breeze moving up the ridge toward them. Silk gave the young man a sour look, crammed his battered hat down lower over his ears, and pulled his shabby cloak tighter about him. He looked at Belgarath.
"I don't suppose that you would consider doing something about this," he asked pointedly.
"It wouldn't be a good idea."
"Sometimes you're a terrible disappointment to me, Belgarath," Silk said, drawing himself even more deeply into his cloak.
It began to snow harder, and the trees about them became hazy and indistinct in the shifting curtain of white that came seething up through the forest. A mile or so farther down the hill, they left the birch trees and entered a dark green forest of towering firs. The thick evergreens broke the force of the wind, and the snow sifted lazily down through the boughs, lightly dusting the needle-strewn floor of the forest. Belgarath shook the snow out of the folds of his cloak and looked around, choosing another route.
"Lost again?"
"Not really."
"No."
The old man looked at Durnick.
"How far down this hill do you think we are going to have to go to get below this?"
Durnick scratched at his chin.
"Well, it's sort of odd to say,"
he replied. He turned to the mute at his side.
"What do you think, Toth?"
The giant lifted his head and sniffed at the air, then made a series of obscure gestures with one hand.
Well, you're probably right,"
Durnick agreed. He turned back to Belgarath.
"If the slope stays this steep, we ought to be able to get below the snow line sometime this afternoon, if we keep moving." "Well, I guess we had better move along, then,"
Belgarath said, and led the way on down the hill at a jolting trot. It continued to snow. The light dusting on the ground beneath the firs became a covering, and the dimness that had hovered among the dark tree trunks faded as the white snow brought its peculiar sourceless light. They stopped about noon and took a quick lunch of bread and cheese, then continued to descend through the forest toward Arindia. By mid-afternoon, as Durnick and Toth had predicted, the snow was mixed with a chill rain. Soon, the few large wet flakes were gone, and they rode through a steady drizzle that wreathed down among the trees. Late in the afternoon, the wind picked up, and the rain driven before it was cold and unpleasant. Durnick looked around.
"Oh, I think it's about time for us to find a place to stop for the night," he said. "We'll need shelter from this wind, and finding dry firewood might be a bit of a problem."
The huge Toth,
whose feet were very nearly dragging on the ground on either side of his horse, looked around and then pointed toward a dense thicket of sapling evergreens standing at the far edge of the broad clearing they had just entered. Once again he began to move his hands in those peculiar gestures. Durnick watched him intently for a few moments, then nodded, and the two of them rode on across to the thicket, dismounted, and then went to work. The campsite they constructed was well back among the slender tree trunks of the thicket, where the force of the wind was broken, and the dense branches shed the rain like a thatched roof. The two of them bent a half-circle of the tall saplings over and tied their tips to the trunks of other trees to form a dome-like framework of considerable size. Then they covered the frame with tent canvas and tied it in place securely. The resulting structure was a round-topped, open-fronted pavilion, perhaps as big as a fair-sized room. At the front, they dug in a fire pit and lined it with rocks. The rain had soaked down through the forest, and collecting dry firewood was difficult. But Geryon drew upon the experience he had gained during the quest for the orb to seek out those sheltered hollows under fallen trees, the spots on the leeward sides of large tree trunks, and the brush-choked areas under overhanging rocks where dry twigs and branches could be found. By evening, he and Arion had piled up a considerable supply of wood not far from the fire pit where Polgara and Tenedra were preparing supper. There was a small spring several hundred yards on down the slope, and Geryon slipped and slid downhill with two leather water bags slung over his shoulders. The light was fading rapidly under the dark, wind-swept evergreens, and the ruddy glow of their campfire beckoned cheerfully as he started back up through the trees, with the full water bags hanging pendulously down against his thighs. Polgara had hung her damp cloak on a tree limb and was humming softly to herself as she and Tenedra worked over the fire.
"Why, thank you, Your Majesty,"
Tenedra said as Geryon handed her the water bags. Her little smile was somehow wistful, as if she were making a conscious effort to be light-hearted.
"It's my pleasure, Your Majesty,"
he replied with a florid bow. "A good scullion can always find water when the cook's helper needs it." She smiled briefly, kissed his cheek, and then sighed, and went back to dicing vegetables for the stew that Polgara was stirring. After they had eaten, they all sat drowsily before the fire, listening to the sound of the wind in the treetops and the seething hiss of the rain in the forest about them.
"How far did we come today?"
Tenedra asked in a voice near sleep, as she leaned wearily against Geryon's shoulder.
"7 or 8 leagues, I'd guess," Durnick replied. "It's slow going, when you don't have a road to follow."
"We will make better time once we hit a high road from Muros to the Great Fair," Silk added. His eyes brightened at that thought, and his long, pointed nose started to twitch.
"Never mind," Belgarath told him.
"Well, we will need supplies, Belgarath," Silk said, his eyes still bright.
"I think we will let Durnick take care of that. People who do business with you always seem to develop their sense of outrage once they have had time to think things through."
"Oh, but, Belgarath, I thought you said that you were in a hurry."
"I don't quite get the connection."
"Well, people always travel faster when somebody's chasing them. Or hadn't you noticed that?"
Belgarath gave him a long, hard look.
"Just let it drop, Silk. Why don't we all get some sleep?" he suggested to the rest of them. "We have got a long day tomorrow."
It was well after midnight when Geryon suddenly started into wakefulness. He lay rolled up in his blankets beside Tenedra, listening to her regular breathing and the soft patter of the rain on the tree limbs. The wind had died, and the fire at the front of their snug shelter had burned down to a few ruddy coals. He shook the last remnants of sleep from his mind, trying to remember what it was that had awakened him.
"Don't make any noise,"
Belgarath said softly from the far side of the shelter.
"Did something wake you too, Grandfather?"
"I want you to get out of your blankets very slowly,"
the old man said in a voice so quiet that it scarcely reached Geryon's ears.
"And get your hands on your sword."
"What is it, Grandfather?"
"Listen,"
Belgarath said. From high overhead in the rainy darkness
there came the ponderous flap of vast wings, and a sudden flare of sooty red light. The wings flapped again, and then the sound was gone.
"Move, Geryon," Belgarath said urgently. "Get your sword. Put something over the orb so that she can't see the glow from it."
Geryon untangled his legs from his blankets and groped in the darkness for Iron Grip's sword. Again there was the vast flapping sound overhead, and then a strange hissing cry, accompanied by another flare of that sooty red light.
"What's that?"
Tsinedra cried out.
"Be still, girl,"
Belgarath snapped. They lay tensely in the darkness as the flapping sound faded off into the rain-swept night.
"What is out there, Belgarath?"
Silk asked tensely.
"She is a very large beast,"
the old man replied quietly.
"Her eyes aren't very good, and she is as stupid as a stump. But she's very dangerous. She is hunting. Possibly she smells the horses. Or us." "How do you know it's she?"
Dernick asked.
"Because there is only one of them left in the world. She does not come out of her cave very often, but over the centuries enough people have got glimpses of her to give rise to all of those legends."
"I'm starting to get a very uneasy feeling about this," Silk murmured.
"She doesn't really look that much like the dragons in all of those drawings," Belgarath continued. "But she is big, and she does fly." "Oh, come now, Belgarath," Dernick scoffed. "There's no such thing as a dragon." "I'm glad to hear it. Now, why don't you go out and explain that to her?"
"Is she the same creature we heard that night in the mountains above Maragor?"
"Yes. Have you got your sword?"
"Right here, Grandfather."
"Good. Now, very slowly, creep out and smother the last embers of the fire. Cover it with dirt. Fire attracts her. So let's not take any chances on a sudden flare-up."
Geryon inched his way out through the open front of the shelter and hurriedly scooped dirt over the fire pit with his hands.
"Is it really a flying lizard?"
Silk whispered hoarsely.
"No," Belgarath replied. "Actually, she is a species of bird. She has a long snake-like tail, and what she is covered with looks more like scales than feathers. She also has teeth, lots of very long, sharp teeth." "Just exactly how big is she?" Dernick asked. "You remember Faldor's barn?" "Yes, about that big."
From quite some distance off, there came another screeching bellow and the murky red glare.
"Her fire isn't really all that serious," Belgarath continued in the same low voice, "particularly since these woods are so wet. It's when she catches you in a dry grass that it starts to be a problem. She's big, but she's not very brave. And on the ground she is as clumsy as a pig on a frozen pond. If it gets down to a fight, we probably won't be able to hurt her very much. About the best we can hope for is to frighten her off."
"Fight?" Silk choked. "You're not serious."
"We may not have any choice. If she is hungry and picks up our scent or the scent of the horses, she will tear these woods apart looking for us. She has a few sensitive spots. Her tail is probably the best. Her wings get in the way, so she can't see behind her too well. And when she is on the ground, she cannot turn very fast."
"Let's see if I have got this straight," Silk said.
"You want us to sneak up behind this dragon and hit her on the tail? Is that it?"
"Approximately, yes."
"Belgarath, have you lost your mind? Why not just use sorcery to drive her away?"
"Because she is immune to sorcery," Polgara explained calmly. "It was one of those little refinements Torak added when he and the other gods created her species. He was so impressed with the concept of a dragon that he chose it as his totem creature. He tried in every way he could to make it invincible."
"It was one of his character defects," Belgarath added sourly. "All right. The dragon is clumsy and stupid, and she is not used to pain.
If we are very careful, we can probably frighten her away without anyone getting hurt.
She's coming back,
Arianne said.
They listened to the flapping of those huge wings sounding through the sodden forest.
Let's get out into the open, Belgarath said tensely.
Oh, that's a good idea, Sulk agreed. If I have to do this, I want lots of level running room around me.
Zinedra,
Bulgara said,
I want you to get back as far as you can into the thicket and find a place to hide.
Yes, Lady Bulgara,
Zinedra replied in a frightened little voice. They crept out of the shelter into the darkness. The rain had slackened to a kind of misty drizzle wreathing down among the trees. Their horses, picketed not far away, snorted nervously, and Garion could smell the sharp odor of their fear over the resinous scent of wet evergreens.
All right, Belgarath whispered. Spread out. Be careful. Do not try to attack her unless you are sure that her attention is someplace else.
They crept out of the thicket into the broad clearing and started across. Garion, sword in hand, moved carefully, feeling for obstructions with his feet. When he reached the far side, he located a large tree trunk and went around behind it. They waited tensely, straining their eyes toward the rain-swept night sky. The heavy flapping of great wings sounded again down among the trees, and once again they heard that vast bellowing. Even as the sound crashed down onto them, Geryon saw the huge billow of smoky flame in the sky overhead, and, outlined by that flame, the shape of the dragon herself. She was even bigger than he had imagined. Her wings might easily have shaded an acre. Her cruel beak was agape, and he could clearly see her pointed teeth with the flames writhing about them. She had a very long snake-like neck, huge talons, and a long reptilian tail that lashed at the air behind her as she plunged down toward the clearing. Then Arianne stepped out from behind a tree trunk and walked out into the center of the clearing as calmly as if he were merely taking a mid-morning stroll.
Arianne,
Polgara cried, as, with a triumphant shriek, the dragon swooped down into the clearing. Talons extended, she struck at the unprotected young man. Her beak gaped, and vast billows of sooty orange flame poured forth to engulf him. With fear for the boy clutching at his heart, Garion ran forward with his sword aloft. But even as he ran at the huge beast, he felt the sudden familiar surge of Aunt Paul's will. And Arianne vanished as she translocated him to safety. The earth shook as the dragon struck the ground, and her vast roar of frustration filled the clearing with the ruddy light of her fire. She was enormous. Her half-folded, scaly-looking wings reared above her higher than any house. Her lashing tail was thicker than the body of a horse, and her curved, tooth-studded beak was dreadful. A sickening stench filled the clearing each time she belched forth her bellows of flame. By the light of her fire, Garion could clearly see her slitted yellow eyes. From what Belgarath had said, he expected a look of dull stupidity, but the burning eyes that searched the clearing were alert and filled with an intense, frightening eagerness. Then Durnik and Toth were upon her. They dashed from the shelter of the trees, Durnik with his axe, and Toth with the smith's sharp-bladed spade. Methodically they began to chop at the dragon's writhing tail. She shrieked, belching flame into the air, and began to claw at the sodden forest loam with her talons.
"Look out!" Silk shouted. "She's turning!"
The dragon whirled awkwardly, her wings beating at the air and her talons throwing up huge clots of earth, but Durnik and Toth had already run back into the shelter of the trees. As she swept the clearing with her burning eyes, Silk nimbly darted out behind her, and with his short, broad-bladed Drasnian sword in his hand, he drove into the base of her huge tail. Then, as she floundered around to meet his attack, he danced clear to regain the safety of the surrounding forest. Then Arianne stepped into the clearing again. Without any sign of fear, but with a grave expression on his face, he walked out of the trees and moved directly toward the raging beast.
"Why are you doing this?" he asked her calmly. "You know that this isn't the time or place."
The dragon almost seemed to flinch back at the sound of his voice, and her burning eyes grew wary.
You can't avoid what's going to happen, he continued seriously. None of us can, and you can't change it with this kind of foolishness. You'd better go. We really don't want to have to hurt you.
The dragon faltered, and Geryon suddenly sensed that she was not only baffled, but that she was also afraid. Then she seemed to clench herself. With an enraged bellow, she sent out a vast sheet of flame from her gaping beak to engulf Eriond, who made no effort to escape. Every nerve in Geryon's body shrieked at him to run to his young friend's aid, but he found that he could not move so much as a muscle. He stood, sword in hand, locked in a kind of helpless stasis. As the billow of flame subsided, Eriond emerged from it unscathed, and with an expression of regretful firmness on his face, he said,
I had hoped that we wouldn't have to do this, but you aren't giving us too much choice, you know. All right, Belgarion, make her go away. But please try not to hurt her too much.
With a kind of surging exultation, as if those words had somehow released him from all restraint, Geryon ran directly up behind the dragon with his suddenly blazing sword and began to rain blows on her unprotected back and tail. The awful reek of burning flesh filled the clearing, and the dragon shrieked with pain. She flailed her huge tail in agony, and it was more to protect himself from that ponderous lashing than out of any conscious effort to injure the beast that Geryon swung a massive blow with Iron Grip's sword. The sharp edge sheared effortlessly through scale and flesh and bone, smoothly lopping off about 4 feet of the writhing tip of the tail. The shriek which thundered from the dragon's beak was shattering, and her fire boiled skyward in a huge cloud. A great jet of streaming blood spurted from the wound the sword had left, splashing into Geryon's face and momentarily blinding him.
Geryon!
Polgara shouted. Look out! He clawed at his eyes to clear away the hot blood. With terrifying agility, the dragon whirled, her talons tearing at the earth and her wings thundering. The orb exploded into intense fire, and its blue flame ran anew up the sword, hissing and smoking as it burned away the thick blood which smeared the blade. In the very act of striking at him with her beak, the dragon flinched back from the incandescence of the burning sword. Geryon raised his blade, and once again the dragon flinched, retreating step by step across the wet clearing. She was afraid. For some reason, the blue fire of the sword frightened her. Shrieking and trying desperately to defend herself with furnace-like gusts of fire, she backed away, her wounded tail still spraying the clearing with blood. There was clearly something about the fire of the orb, which she found unbearable. Once again filled with that wild surge of excitement, Geryon raised his sword and a searing pillar of fire erupted from its tip. He began to lash at the dragon with that whip of flame, and he heard the crackling sizzle as it seared her wings and shoulders. Fiercely he flogged at her with the flame of his sword until, with a howl of agony, she turned and fled, tearing the earth with her talons and desperately flapping the huge sails of her wings. Ponderously, she hurled herself into the air and clawed at the night with her wings, struggling to lift her vast bulk. She crashed through the upper branches of the firs at the edge of the clearing, fighting in panic to rise above the forest until she was clear. Shrieking, she flew off toward the southwest, filling the murky air with seething clouds of fire and streaming blood behind her as she went. A stunned silence fell over them all as they looked up at the great beast fleeing through the rainy sky. Polgara, her face dreadfully pale, came out from under the trees to confront Eriond.
"Just exactly what were you thinking of?"
she asked him in a terribly quiet voice.
"I don't quite follow you, Polgara,"
he replied, looking puzzled. She controlled herself with an obvious effort.
"Doesn't the word danger have any meaning to you at all?" You mean the dragon? Oh, she wasn't really all that dangerous.
She did sort of bear you up to the eyebrows in fire, Eriond, Silk pointed out.
Oh, that,
Eriond smiled.
But the fire wasn't real.
He looked around at the rest of them.
Didn't you all know that?
He asked,
looking slightly surprised.
It was only an illusion. That's all that evil ever really is. An illusion. I'm sorry if any of you were worried, but I didn't have time to explain.
Aunt Paul stared at the unperturbed young man for a moment, then turned her eyes on Geryon, who stood still holding his burning sword.
And you...
Words somehow failed her. Slowly, she sank her face into her trembling hands.
Two of them,
she said in a terrible voice.
Two of them! I don't think I can stand this. Not two of them!
Durnick looked at her gravely, then handed his axe to the giant Toth. He stepped over and put his arm about her shoulders.
There, there, he said.
For a moment she seemed to resist, but then she suddenly buried her face in his shoulder.
Come along now, Paul, he said soothingly,
and gently turned her around to walk her back to their shelter.
Things won't seem nearly so bad in the morning.
Chapter 3 Geryon slept very little during the remainder of that rainy night. His pulse still raced with excitement, and he lay under his blankets beside Zinedra, living and reliving his encounter with the dragon. It was only toward the tag end of the night that he became calm enough to consider an idea that had come to him in the midst of the fight. He had enjoyed it. He had actually enjoyed a struggle that should have terrified him. The more he thought about it, the more he realized that this was not the first time that this had happened. As far back as his early childhood, this same wild excitement had filled him each time he had been in danger. The solid good sense of his Sindarin upbringing told him that this enthusiasm for conflict and peril was probably an unhealthy outgrowth of his Aelorn heritage, and that he should strive to keep it rigidly controlled. But, deep inside, he knew that he would not. He had finally found the answer to the plaintive, "Why me?" which he had voiced so often in the past. He was inevitably chosen for these dreadful, frightening tasks, because he was perfectly suited for them.
"It's what I do," he muttered to himself. "Any time there's something so ridiculously dangerous that no rational human being would even consider trying it, they send for me."
"What was that, Geryon?"
Zinedra murmured drowsily.
"Oh, nothing, dear. I was just thinking out loud. Go back to sleep."
"Mm-hmm,"
she murmured, and snuggled closer to him, filling his nostrils with the warm fragrance of her hair. Dawn crept slowly under the overspreading limbs of the sodden forest with a kind of growing paleness. The persistent drizzle joined with a morning mist, rising from the forest floor to form a kind of damp gray cloud enveloping the dark trunks of fir and spruce. Geryon awoke from a half-doze and saw the shadowy forms of Durnick and Toth standing quietly beside the cold fire-pit of the front of the shelter. He slipped out from under the blankets, moving carefully to avoid waking his sleeping wife. He pulled on his clammy boots, then stood up, pulled on his cloak, and moved out from under the tent canvas to join them. He looked up toward the gloomy morning sky.
Still raining, I see, he noted in that quiet tone people use when they rise before the sun.
Durnick nodded.
Well, this time of year, probably won't blow over for a week or so.
He opened the leather pouch at his hip and took out his wad of tinder.
"I suppose we'd better get the fire going."
Toth, huge and silent, went over to the side of their shelter, picked up two leather water bags, and started down the steep slope toward the spring. Despite his enormous size, he made almost no sound as he moved through the fog-shrouded bushes. Durnick knelt by the fire pit and carefully heaped dry twigs into the center. Then he laid his ball of tinder beside the twigs and took out his flint and steel.
"Is Aunt Paul still asleep?"
Geryon asked.
She's dozing. She says it's very pleasant to lie in bed asleep while someone else builds up the fire."
Durnick smiled gently. Geryon also smiled.
That's probably because for all of those years she was usually the first one up. Is she still unhappy about last night?
Oh, Durnick said, bending over the pit and striking his flint with the steel. I think she's regained her composure a bit.
His flint and steel made a subdued clicking sound, with each click a shower of bright, lingering sparks spilling down into the pit. One of them fell glowing onto the tinder, and the smith gently blew on it until a tiny tongue of orange flame rose from the center. Then he carefully moved the tinder under the twigs. The flame grew and spread with a dry, crackling noise.
"Ah, there we are," he said, brushing the fire from the tinder and returning it to his pouch along with his flint and steel.
Geryon knelt beside him and began snapping a dry branch into short lengths.
"You were very brave last night, Geryon," Durnick said as the two of them fed the small fire.
"I think the word is insane,"
Geryon replied wryly. "Would anybody in his right mind try to do something like that? I think the trouble is that I'm usually right in the middle of those things before I give any thought to how dangerous they are. Sometimes I wonder if Grandfather wasn't right. Maybe Aunt Paul did drop me on my head when I was a baby."
Durnick chuckled softly. "I sort of doubt it. She's very careful with children and other breakable things."
They added more branches to the fire until they had a cheerful blaze going. Then Geryon stood up. The firelight reflected back from the fog with a soft, ruddy glow that had about it a kind of hazy unreality, as if all unaware they had inadvertently crossed the boundaries of the real world sometime during the night and entered the realms of magic and enchantment. As Toth came back up from the spring with the two dripping water bags, Polgara emerged from their shelter, brushing her long dark hair. For some reason, the single white lock above her left brow seemed almost incandescent this morning.
"It's a very nice fire, dear," she said, kissing her husband.
Then she looked at Geryon.
"Are you all right?" she asked him.
"What? Oh, yes, I'm fine. No cuts or bruises or singes you might have overlooked last night?"
"No, I seem to have gotten through it without a scratch."
He hesitated.
"Were you really upset last night, Aunt Paul? With Eriand and me, I mean?"
"Yes, Geryon, I really was.
But that was last night. What would you like for breakfast this morning?"
Some time later, as the pale dawn crept steadily under the trees, Silk stood shivering on one side of the fire pit with his hands outstretched to the flames, and his eyes suspiciously fixed on the bubbling pot that Aunt Paul had set on a flat rock at the very edge of the fire.
"Gruel?" he asked.
"Again?" "Hot porridge," Aunt Paul corrected, stirring the contents of the pot with a long-handled wooden spoon.
"They're the same thing, Polgara."
"Oh, not really. Gruel is thinner."
"Oh, thick or thin, it is all the same."
She looked at him with one raised eyebrow.
"Tell me, Prince Skeldar, why are you always so disagreeable in the morning?"
"Oh, because I detest mornings. The only reason there is such a thing as morning in the first place is to keep night and afternoon from bumping into each other."
"Perhaps one of my tonics might sweeten your blood?"
His eyes grew wary.
"No. Thanks all the same, Polgara. Now that I'm all the way awake, I feel much better."
"I am so glad for you. Now, do you suppose you could move away a bit? I'm going to need that side of the fire for the bacon."
"Oh, anything you say."
And he turned and went quickly back into the shelter. Belgarath, who was lounging on top of his blankets, looked at the little man with an amused expression.
"What a supposedly intelligent man. You do have a tendency to blunder from time to time, don't you? You should have learned by now not to bother Paul when she's cooking."
Silk grunted and picked up his moth-eaten fur cape.
"I think I shall go check on the horses. Do you want to come along?"
Belgarath cast an appraising eye at Polgara's dwindling supply of firewood.
"That might not be a bad idea," he agreed, rising to his feet.
"I'll go with you,"
Geryon said.
I've got a few kinks I'd like to work out. I think I slept on a stump last night."
He slung the loop of his sword belt across one shoulder and followed the other two out of the shelter.
"It is sort of hard to believe that it really happened, isn't it?"
Silk murmured when they reached the clearing.
"The dragon, I mean. Now that it's daylight, everything looks so prosaic."
"Not quite," Geryon said, pointing at the scaly chunk of the dragon's tail lying on the far edge of the clearing. The tip end of it was still twitching slightly. Silk nodded.
"That is the sort of thing you wouldn't ordinarily run across on a casual morning stroll."
He looked at Belgrath.
"Is she likely to bother us again? This is going to be a very nervous journey if we have to keep looking back over our shoulders every step of the way. Is she all that vindictive?"
"How do you mean?" the old man asked him.
"Well, Geryon did kind of cut her tail off, after all. Do you think she might take it personally?"
"Not usually," Belgarath replied. "She doesn't really have that much in the way of a brain."
He frowned thoughtfully.
"What bothers me is that there was something about the whole encounter that was all wrong."
"Oh, even the idea of it was wrong," Silk shuddered.
Belgarath shook his head.
"That's not what I mean. I can't be sure if I imagined it or not. But she seemed to be looking specifically for one of us."
"Eriand?"
Geryon suggested. "Sort of seemed that way, didn't it? But when she found him, she looked almost as if he frightened her. And what did he mean by those peculiar things he said to her?"
"Who knows?
He's always been a strange boy," Silk shrugged.
"I don't think he lives in the same world with the rest of us."
"But why was the dragon so afraid of Geryon's sword?"
"That sword frightens entire armies, Belgarath. The fire alone is pretty terrifying."
"She likes fire, Silk. I have seen her try to be coy and seductive for the benefit of a burning barn. One time she flew around for a week making calves' eyes at a forest fire. There is something about last night that keeps nagging at me."
Eriand came out of the thicket where the horses were picketed, walking carefully around the dripping bushes.
"Are they all right?"
Geryon asked.
"The horses? They're fine, Belgarion. Is breakfast almost ready?"
"If that's what you want to call it," Silk said sourly.
"Polgara is really a very good cook, Keldar,"
Eriand assured him earnestly.
"Not even the best cook in the world can do very much with porridge."
Arion's eyes brightened.
"She's making porridge? I love porridge."
Silk gave him a long look, then turned sadly to Geryon.
"You see how easily the young are corrupted. Just give them the faintest hint of a wholesome upbringing, and they're lost forever."
He squared his shoulders.
"All right, let's go get it over with."
After breakfast, they broke down their night's encampment and set out through the soft drizzle falling from the weeping sky. It was about noon when they reached a wide swath of cleared land, a stretch of bushy, stump-dotted ground perhaps a quarter of a mile wide, and in the center of that swath lay a wide, muddy road.
"The high road from Muros,"
Silk said with some satisfaction.
"Why did they cut down all the trees?"
Arion asked him.
"They used to have trouble with robbers lying in ambush right beside the road. The cleared space on each side gives travelers a sporting chance to get away."
They rode out from under the dripping trees and across the weed-grown clearing to the muddy road.
"Now we should be able to make better time,"
Belgarath said, nudging his horse into a trot. They followed the road south for several hours, moving at a steady canter. As they rode down out of the forested foothills, the trees gave way to rolling grasslands. They crested a hilltop and reined in to give their steaming mounts a brief rest. Somewhat to the northwest, they saw the dark border of the great Orendish forest, hazy in the misty drizzle, and not far ahead the grim gray-walled pile of Mimbrate Castle brooding down on the grasslands lying below.
Tenedra sighed as she stared out over the sodden plain, and at the fortress that seemed to hold in its very stones all the stiff-necked, wary suspicion that was at the core of a Orendish society.
"Are you all right?"
Garion asked her, fearful that her sigh might signify a return to that bleak melancholy which she had so recently shaken off.
"There is something so mournful about Orinthia,"
she replied.
"All those thousands of years of hatred and grief, what did they prove? Even that castle seems to be weeping."
"That's just the rain, Sinedra."
"No. It is more than that."
The road from Muros was a muddy yellow scar stretching between fields of browned, drooping grasses as it wound down to the Arendish plain. And for the next several days they rode past great rearing membrate castles and through dirty thatch and wattle villages where acrid smoke hung in the chill air like a miasma, and the hopeless expressions on the faces of the ragged serfs bespoke lives lived out in misery and despair. They stopped each night in mean, shabby wayside inns reeking of spoiled food and unwashed bodies. On the fourth day, they crested a hill and looked down at the garish sprawl of the great Arendish fair, standing at the junction of the high road from Muros and the great west road. The tents and pavilions spread for a league or more in every direction in a gaudy profusion of blue and red and yellow beneath a weeping gray sky. Packed trains were going to and from that great commercial center, crawling across the plains like streams of ants. Silk pushed his shabby hat back from his face. "Maybe I had better go down and take a quick look around before we all ride in. We have been out of touch for a while, and it might not hurt to get the feel of things."
"All right," Belgarath agreed. "But no chicanery."
"Chicanery?
You know what I mean, Silk. Keep your instincts under control."
"Oh, trust me, Belgarath.
Not if I can help it."
Silk laughed and thumped his heels to his horse's flanks. The rest of them rode at a walk down the long slope as Silk galloped on ahead toward that perpetually temporary tent city standing in its sea of mud. As they approached the fair, Garion could hear a cacophonous tumult filling the air, a sort of bawling clamor of thousands of voices shouting all at once. There was also a myriad of scents, spices and cooking food, rare perfumes and of horse corrals. Belgarath drew in his mount.
"Let's wait here for Silk. I don't want to blunder into anything."
They sat their horses to one side of the road in the chill rain, watching the slow crawl of pack trains slipping and sliding up the muddy road toward them. About 3/4 of an hour later, Silk came pounding back up the hill.
"I think we might want to approach carefully," he said, his pointed face serious.
"What's the matter?"
"I ran into Delvor," Silk replied, "and he told me that there is an Angrak merchant who has been asking questions about us."
"Maybe we should just bypass the fair, then," Durnick suggested.
Silk shook his head.
"I think we ought to find out a little bit more about this curious Angrak. Delvor's offered to put us up in his tents for a day or so, but it might not be a bad idea if we circle the fair and come in from the south. We can join one of the caravans coming up from Tolhanath. That way, we won't be quite so obvious."
Belgarath considered it, squinting up at the raining sky.
"All right," he decided. "I don't want to waste too much time, but I don't like the idea of someone following us either. Let's go see what Delvor can tell us."
They rode in a wide half-circle through the rain-drenched grass and reached the muddy track of the Great West Road a mile or so south of the fair. A half-dozen Tolnedran merchants, wrapped in rich fur cloaks, rode at the head of a string of creaking wagons, and Garion and his friends unobtrusively fell in at the tail end of their column as the gradual darkening of the sky announced the approach of a dreary, rain-swept evening. The narrow lanes lying between the tents and pavilions seethed with merchants from all parts of the world. The soupy mud was ankle-deep, churned by the hooves of hundreds of horses and the feet of brightly dressed men of trade who bawled and shouted and haggled with each other, ignoring the mud and the rain. Torches and lanterns hung at the sides of the open-fronted booths made of canvas, where treasures of incalculable worth stood in curious proximity to brass pots and cheap tin plates.
"It is this way," Silk said, turning toward a side lane.
Delvor's tents are a few hundred yards up on ahead.
Who is Delvor?
Tenedra asked Geryon as they rode past a noisy tavern pavilion.
A friend of Silk's. We met him the last time we were here. I think he's a member of the Drasnian Intelligence, she sniffed.
Aren't all Drasnians members of the Intelligence Service?
He grinned.
Probably.
Delvor was waiting for them in front of his blue and white striped pavilion. Silk's friend had changed very little in the years since Geryon had last seen him. He was as bald as an egg, and his expression was still as shrewd and cynical as it had been before. He wore a fur-trimmed cloak pulled tightly about his shoulders, and his bald head gleamed wetly in the rain.
"My servants will care for your horses," he told them as they dismounted. "Let's get in out of sight before there are too many people seeing you."
They followed him into his warm, well-lighted pavilion, and he carefully tied down the tent flap behind them. The pavilion was very nearly as comfortable-looking as a well-appointed house. There were chairs and divans and a large, polished table set with a splendid supper. The floors and walls were carpeted in blue, oil lamps hung on chains from the ceiling, and in each corner there was an iron brazier filled with glowing coals. Delvor's servants all wore sober livery, and they wordlessly took the dripping cloaks from Geryon and his friends, carrying them through a canvas partition toward an adjoining tent.
"Please," Delvor said politely, "seat yourselves. I took the liberty of having a bit of supper prepared."
Silk looked around as they all sat down at the table.
"Opulent," he noted.
Delvor shrugged.
"A little planning. And quite a bit of money. A tent doesn't have to be uncomfortable."
"And it's portable," Silk added. "If one has to leave someplace in a hurry, a tent can be folded up and taken along. Hard to do with a house."
"Yes, there is that too," Delvor admitted blandly. "Please, eat, my friends. I know the kind of accommodations and the meals that are offered in the inns here in Arindia."
The supper that had been set for them was as fine a one as they might have come to at the table of a nobleman. A heap of smoking chops lay on a silver platter, and there were boiled onions and peas and carrots swimming in a delicate cheese sauce. The bread was of the finest white, still steaming hot from the oven, and there was a wide selection of excellent wines.
"Your cook appears to be a man of some talent, Delvor,"
Polgara noted.
"Thank you, my lady," he replied. "He costs me a few dozen extra crowns a year, and he has got a foul temper. But I think he is worth the expense and the aggravation."
"What's this about a curious Angarak merchant?"
Belgarath asked, helping himself to a couple of the chops.
"He rode into the fair a few days ago, with a half-dozen servants, but no pack horses or wagons. Their horses looked hard-ridden, as if he and his men had come here in a hurry. Since he arrived, he has not done any business at all. He and his people have spent all of their time asking questions."
"Are they specifically looking for us?"
"Not by name, Ancient One. But the way they have been describing you does not leave much doubt. He's been offering money for information. Quite a bit of money."
"What kind of Angarak is he?"
"He claims to be an Adrak. But if he is an Adrak, I am a Tull. I think he is a Malorian. He's about medium height and build, clean-shaven and soberly dressed. About the only thing unusual about him is his eyes. They seem to be completely white, except for the pupils. There is no color to them at all."
Aunt Paul raised her head quickly.
"Blind?"
she asked.
"Blind? No, I don't think so. He seems to be able to see where he is going. Why do you ask, my lady?"
"What you just described is the result of a very rare condition. Most of the people who suffer from it are blind."
"If we're going to ride out of here without having him about 10 minutes behind us, we're going to need some kind of distraction to delay him," Silk said, toying with a crystal goblet. He looked at his friend.
"I don't suppose you have any of those lead coins you hid in that Murgo tent the last time we were here, do you?" I am afraid not, Silk. I had to go through customs at the Tonedrin border a few months ago. I did not think it would be wise to have the customs people find that kind of thing in my packs, so I buried them under a tree.
Lead coins?
Zinedra said with a puzzled look.
What could you possibly buy with coins made of lead?
They're gilded, Your Majesty, Delvor told her. They look exactly like Tonedrin gold crowns.
Zinedra's face suddenly went pale.
But that's horrible,
she gasped. Delvor's face mirrored his puzzlement at the vehemence of her reaction.
Her Majesty, is a Tonedrin, Delvor, Silk reminded him. And counterfeit money strikes at the very core of a Tonedrin's being. I think it has something to do with their religion.
I don't find that particularly amusing, Prince Keldar,
Zinedra said tartly. After supper, they talked for a while longer, the comfortable talk of people who are warm and well-fed, and then Delvor led them into an adjoining tent that had been partitioned off into sleeping chambers. Geryon fell asleep almost as soon as his head touched the pillow, and he awoke the following morning, feeling more refreshed than he had in weeks. He dressed quietly to avoid waking Zinedra, and went out into the main pavilion. Silk and Delvor sat at the table talking quietly.
There's a great deal of ferment going on here in Arindia, Delvor was saying. The news of the campaign against the Bearcult in the Elorn Kingdoms has stirred the blood of all of the young hotheads, both Mimbrite and Asturian. The thought of a fight someplace that they were not invited to attend fills young Erends with anguish.
Oh, there's nothing new about that. Oh, good morning, Geryon, Silk said.
Gentlemen, Geryon said politely, pulling up a chair.
Your Majesty, Delvor greeted him.
Then he turned back to Silk.
The thing that concerns everybody, more than the casual belligerence of the young nobles, is the unrest that has arisen among the serfs.
Geryon remembered the miserable hovels in the villages they had passed in the last few days, and the hopeless looks on the faces of their inhabitants.
They have reason enough for discontent, don't you think?
Oh, I would be the first to agree, Your Majesty, Delvor said. And it is not the first time that it has happened. This time, though, it is a little more serious. The authorities have been finding caches of weapons, fairly sophisticated ones. A serf with a pitchfork isn't much of a match for an armored Mimbrite knight. A serf with a crossbow, however, is an altogether different matter. There have been several incidents and some reprisals.
How could serfs get those kind of weapons? Geryon asked. Most of the time they don't even have enough to eat. How could they possibly afford to buy crossbows?
They are coming in from outside the country. We have not been able to pinpoint the source yet, but it is fairly obvious that somebody wants to make sure that the Arindish nobility is too busy at home to get involved in anything anyplace else.
Karazakath, perhaps, Silk suggested.
That is entirely possible. There is no question that the Emperor of Meloria has global ambitions, and turmoil in the kingdoms of the West would be his best ally, if he decides to turn his armies northward after he finally kills King Urgit.
Geryon groaned.
Oh, that's all I need. One more thing to worry about.
When the others joined them in the main pavilion, Delvor's servants brought in a huge breakfast. There were whole platters of eggs, heaps of bacon and sausage, and plate after plate of fruit and rich pastries.
Now, this is what I call a breakfast, Silk said enthusiastically.
Polgara gave him a cool look.
Go ahead and say it, Prince Keldar. I am sure that you have all sorts of interesting observations to make.
Would I say anything about that excellent gruel you offer us every morning, dear lady? He asked, with exaggerated innocence.
Not if you are at all concerned about your health, you wouldn't,
Zinedra said sweetly. One of the servants entered the tent with an offended expression on his face.
There is an obnoxious, filthy hunchback outside, Delvor. He has the foulest mouth I have ever run across, and he is demanding to be let in.
Do you want us to chase him off?
Oh, that would be Uncle Belden, Polgara said.
You know him? Delvor seemed surprised.
Oh, I've known him since I was a baby. He's not really as bad as he seems, once you get used to him.
She frowned slightly.
You probably ought to let him come in. He can be terribly unpleasant when people irritate him.
Belgarath,
Belden growled roughly, pushing his way past the protesting servant.
Is this all the farther you've come? I thought you'd be in Tol Hanath by now.
We had to stop at Prolgu to see the Gorum, Belgarath replied mildly.
This isn't a grand tour, you blockhead, Belden snapped irritably.
The little hunchback was as filthy as ever. The wet rags he wore for clothes were tied to his body here and there with lengths of rotten twine. His hair was matted, and he had twigs and bits of straw clinging to it. His hideous face was as black as a thundercloud as he stumped to the table on his short, gnarled legs and helped himself to a bit of sausage.
"Please try to be civil, Uncle,"
Aunt Paul said.
"Why?"
He pointed at a small pot standing on the table.
"What's in that?"
"Jam," Delvor replied, looking slightly intimidated.
"Interesting," Belden said.
He dipped one dirty hand into the pot and began feeding gobs of jam into his mouth.
"Not bad," he said, licking his fingers.
"There is bread right there, Uncle,"
Aunt Paul said pointedly.
"I don't like bread,"
he grunted, wiping his hands on his clothes.
"Did you manage to catch up with Harrigan?"
Belgarath asked him. Belden retorted with a number of expletives that made Tenedra's face blanch.
"He gave me the slip again. I don't have the time to waste chasing him, so I'll have to forego the pleasure of splitting him up the middle."
He dipped his hand into the jam pot again.
"If we run across him, we'll take care of it for you,"
Silk offered.
"He's a sorcerer, Kaldar. If you get in his way, he'll hang your guts on a fence."
"I was going to let Garion do it."
Belden set down the empty jam pot and belched.
"Can I offer you anything else?"
Delvor asked him.
"No, thanks all the same. I'm full now."
He turned back to Belgarath.
"Are you planning to get as far as Tol Hanath before summer?"
"We are not really that far behind, Belden,"
Belgarath protested. Belden made an indelicate sound.
"Keep your eyes open on the way to the south," he advised. "There's a Malorian who's been asking questions about you and the others. He's been hiring people all up and down the Great West Road."
Belgarath looked at him sharply.
"Could you get any kind of a name?"
"Oh, he uses several. The one that crops up most often is Naradus."
"Have you gotten the idea of what he looks like?"
Silk asked.
"About all I've been able to pick up is the fact that he's got funny eyes. From what I've been told, they're all white."
"Well," Delvor said. "Well, well, well."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Belden asked him.
"The man with the white eyes is right here in the fair. He's been asking questions here, too."
"Oh, that makes it fairly easy, then. Have somebody go run a knife into his back."
Belgarath shook his head.
"The legionnaires who police this fair get excited when unexplained bodies start showing up."
Belden shrugged.
"Wrap him on the head with something, then drag him a few miles out into the plain. Cut his throat and dump him in a hole. He probably won't sprout until spring."
He looked over at Polgara with a sly grin creasing his ugly face.
"You keep nibbling on that pastry, girl. You're going to spread. You're chubby enough already."
"Chubby?"
"Oh, that's all right, Paul. Some men like girls with fat bottoms."
"Why don't you wipe the jam out of your beard, Uncle?"
"I'm saving it for lunch."
He scratched at one armpit.
"Lice again?"
she asked coolly.
"It's always possible. I don't mind a few lice, though. They're better company than most people I know."
"Where are you going now?" Belgarath asked him.
"Back to Meloria. I want to root around in Dar Shiva for a while and see what I can dig up about Zandramas."
Delvor had been looking at the grimy little man with a speculative squint.
"Were you planning to leave immediately, Master Belden?"
"Why?"
"I'd like a word with you in private, if you have got a few moments."
"Secrets, Delvor?"
Silk asked. "Not really, old boy. I've got sort of an idea, but I would like to get it a bit more developed before I tell you about it."
He turned back to the hunchback.
"Why don't we take a little stroll, Master Belden? I have a notion that might appeal to you, and it really won't take very long."
Belden's look was curious.
"All right," he agreed,
and the two of them went outside into the drizzling morning.
"What was that all about?"
Garion asked Silk.
"It is an irritating habit Delvor picked up at the Academy. He likes to pull off clever ploys without any advance warning. That way he can sit around afterward and bask in everyone's stunned admiration." The little man looked at the table. "I believe I'll have just a bit more of that sausage, and maybe a few more eggs. It is a long way to Tohaneth, and I would like to put in a buffer against all that gruel."
Polgara looked at Sinedra.
"Have you ever noticed that when some people find a notion they think is funny, they tend to keep playing with it long past the point where it bores everyone else to tears?"
Sinedra looked at Silk with a sly little twinkle in her eyes.
"I have noticed that, Lady Polgara. Do you suppose it might be the result of a limited imagination?"
"I'm sure that has something to do with it, dear."
Aunt Polgara looked at Silk with a serene smile.
"Now, did you want to play some more, Keldar?"
No, Polgara. I don't really think so."
It was shortly before noon when Delvor and Belden returned, each with a self-satisfied smirk on his face.
"It was truly a masterful performance, Master Belden,"
Delvor congratulated the little hunchback as they entered.
"Child's play,"
Belden shrugged deprecatingly.
"People inevitably believe that a deformed body houses a defective brain. I've used that to my advantage many times."
"I'm sure they'll tell us what this is all about eventually," Silk said.
"It wasn't too complicated, Silk,"
Delvor told him.
"You'll be able to leave now without any worries about that curious Malorian."
"Oh?"
"He was trying to buy information," Delvor shrugged. "So we sold him some, and he left. At a full gallop."
"What sort of information did you sell him?" "It went sort of like this,"
Belden said. He stooped a bit more, deliberately exaggerating his deformity, and his face took on an expression of vapid imbecility.
"An' it please your honor,"
he said in a squeaky voice, dripping with servile stupidity.
"I hears that you wants to find some people, and that you says you'll pay to know where they be. I see the people you're looking for, and I can tell you where they was. If you give me some money, enough money, how much was you willing to pay?"
Delvor laughed delightedly.
"Narrathus swallowed it whole. I took Master Belden to him and told him that I'd found someone who knew about the people he was looking for. We agreed to a price, and then your friend here gulled him completely."
"Which way did you send him?"
"North,"
Belden shrugged.
"I told him that I'd seen you camped by the roadside up in the Orindish forest, that one of the members of your party had fallen sick, and that you'd stopped to nurse him back to health."
"Wasn't he at all suspicious?"
Delvor shook his head.
"The thing that makes people suspicious is help that comes for no particular reason. I gave Narrathus every reason to believe that I was sincere. I cheated Master Belden outrageously. Narrathus gave him a few silver coins for his information. My price, however, was much higher."
"Oh, it's brilliant,"
Silk murmured admiringly.
"There's something you ought to know about old White Eyes, though," Belden told Belgarath. "He's a Malorian Grolem. I didn't probe him too hard, because I didn't want him to catch what I was doing, but I was able to get that much. He's got a great deal of power, so watch out for him."
"Did you find out who he is working for?"
Belden shook his head. "I pulled back as soon as I found out what he was."
The hunchback's face grew bleak.
"Be careful about this one, Belgarath. He's very dangerous."
Belgarath's face grew grim. "So am I, Belden. So am I."
"I know. But there are some things you won't do. Noradus doesn't feel that kind of restraint."
Chapter 4 They rode south under clearing skies for the next 6 days. A cold wind bent the winter-browned grass at the sides of the road, and the rolling plain of southern Arindia lay dead and sere beneath a chill blue sky. They passed an occasional mud and wattle village where ragged serfs clenched themselves to endure yet another winter, and, more infrequently, a rearing stone keep where a proud membrate baron kept a watchful eye on his neighbors. The Great West Road, like all roads that formed a part of the Tolnedran highway system, was patrolled by scarlet-cloaked Imperial legionnaires. Geryon and his friends also encountered an occasional merchant traveling northward with wary eyes, and accompanied by burly hirelings whose hands never strayed far from their weapons. They reached the River Erend on a frosty mid-morning, and looked across the sparkling ford of the Forest of Vordu in northern Tolnedra.
"Did you want to stop at Vomimbre?" Silk asked Belgarath.
The old man shook his head.
"Mandaralan and Laldaran have probably already advised Coradulan about what happened in Dresnia, and I am not really in the mood for 3 or 4 days of speeches filled with these and thous and forasmuches. Besides, I want to get to Tolhanath as soon as possible."
As they splashed through the shallow waters of the ford, Geryon remembered something.
"Will we have to stop at that customs station?"
"Oh, naturally," Silk replied. "Everybody has to go through customs, except for licensed smugglers, of course."
He looked over at Belgarath.
"Do you want me to handle things when we get there?" "Just don't get too creative." "Nothing could have been further from my mind, Belgarath. All I want is a chance to try these out."
He indicated the seedy clothing he wore.
"I've been sort of wondering what you had in mind when you picked your wardrobe," Durnick said.
Silk gave him a sly wink. They rode up out of the ford and onto the Forest of Vordu, with its neatly spaced trees and groomed undergrowth,